As you know, it's important to me that the supplements I recommend and use are of the highest quality. That's why I stock the Protocol for Life Balance product line at my online dispensary, drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance offers a wide range of professional-grade products using ingredients backed by strong scientific research, including a suite of supplements that support mood and sleep: L-tryptophan, 5-HTP, GABA, and L-theanine. This collection provides essential amino acids and a serotonin precursor that support relaxation, restful sleep, and the regulation of mood and sleep-wake cycles, and are available in various potencies tailored to your specific needs. For more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance is an A-rated GMP manufacturer of premium dietary supplements created for healthcare practitioners. Their formulations are based on the latest advances in nutritional science. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And now for something completely different. I think this may be the very first time that we've aired this subject here on Intelligent Medicine. It's the epidemic you never heard of. It's the crossroads between tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease and food allergy. And it's a very weird phenomenon. Today's guest is Sharon Forsyth. She has created the Alpha-Gal Syndrome Awareness Campaign with the purpose of raising awareness about Alpha-Gal Syndrome and providing information about AGS, as it's abbreviated for the Alpha-Gal community, for their friends, families, and healthcare providers, as well as for the media and researchers, because we actually need to create awareness about alpha-gal. Unbeknownst to some of you, you may have alpha-gal. A loved one or a friend may be suffering from bewildering symptoms, and it may be due to alpha-gal syndrome. And so Sharon has a background in the conservation movement. But after being diagnosed with alpha-gal syndrome in 2019, she searched for information that would help her navigate this complex condition. But she found little, and even allergists had little familiarity with it, and many weren't able to help. So she did a deep dive on the subject. Now she's an expert. She heads a community of common sufferers, a patient awareness group, the Alpha-Gal Syndrome Awareness Campaign. And so without further ado, here's Sharon. Sharon, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to speak with you.
Okay, indeed. It may be a little irreverent, but, I might refer to you as the Alpha-Gal. I've heard that before.
I have heard that one before, but
okay.
I'll have to answer to that.
I'll refrain. Tell us a little bit about what this is. What is alpha-gal syndrome?
Yes. Alpha-gal syndrome is an allergy to a sugar, unlike most allergies, which are to proteins. And the sugar is, for short, it's called alpha-gal. And it's produced by all non-primate mammals and some other organisms as well. For patients who have alpha-gal syndrome, it's primates, non-mammalian primates are our biggest problem in terms of foods and other exposures.
Okay. And so it's commonly referred to as a meat allergy. Is that a misnomer?
It absolutely is a misnomer. People originally... when it was first discovered, it was discovered in people who reported having reactions to red meat. And at that time, they didn't realize that there was that there were people who reacted to mammalian, other mammalian products like dairy and gelatin and even mammalian byproducts and all kinds of things, from processed foods to personal care products to household products, to even fumes produced by cooking meat. So it's absolutely not a red meat allergy. It's much more than that for about 50% of the population.
So it's not for people who are sort of thinking now, they might be thinking, oh my goodness, you know, I had a steak the other day and I just felt, I felt like it hit my stomach like a ton of bricks. Maybe I have a meat allergy. It goes way beyond that sensation of satiety or fullness, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, in my case, I had full-blown anaphylaxis, and 60% of us do have anaphylactic reactions after eating red meat. And often our reactions to different exposures present differently. So, you know, for example, in my case, if I eat red meat, I have an anaphylactic reaction. If I eat dairy, I get GI pain and other GI symptoms. If I eat gelatin, I actually get reflux.
So that would preclude vitamins for a lot of people. Many vitamins are in gel caps.
Absolutely, or gummy vitamins. Mm-hmm. Actually, my most severe gelatin reaction was to a gummy vitamin.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps also collagen product, you know, collagen protein, things like that would have traces of alpha-gal.
Absolutely. And for people who are very sensitive, for about 2% of the population, they react to even trace amounts of alpha-gal in things like magnesium stearate or lactose. So that's about 20,000 drugs right there that they have to avoid.
And how about topical things? Certain products are animal protein derived that you apply to the skin, cosmetic products and skincare products.
Yes. You know, when I was first diagnosed, I had no idea that I would be allergic to anything other than red meat. And I started breaking out in rashes, but it became pretty obvious that it was my personal care products because of where the rashes were. But lanolin is probably the biggest offender.
Mm-hmm.
Many people who don't react to other byproducts and
it's derived from sheep's wool.
Absolutely. It's derived from sheep's wool. But there are other things as well, like glycerin. That's a big problem for a lot of people. Numerous mammalian byproducts.
Mm-hmm.
One of the projects that we've done is to create a database of mammalian byproducts because there wasn't one. There was no list of mammalian byproducts. We called everybody, you know, the beef lobbyists, the USDA.
Mm-hmm.
And we identified over 600.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about your journey. How did you become aware of this? And then, you know, it seems like a lot of people go to doctors and doctors even have less awareness of this or they confuse it for other conditions. How long did it take you to get a proper diagnosis?
Well, I've probably suffered from alpha-gal syndrome for most of my life. But I actually only learned about it 2 weeks before I received 5 tick bites in a row, which caused, when you have alpha-gal syndrome, if you're bitten by a tick, your symptoms tend to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I was bitten by 5 ticks within a 2-week period. And during that period, a friend who's an ornithologist actually told me about alpha-gal syndrome. So I was bitten by these ticks. 2 weeks later, I ate a hamburger and I didn't normally eat red meat even back then. And, I had an anaphylactic reaction. And I thought of all those medical students who learn about a rare condition and then they develop it.
Yeah.
So it was really suspicious that maybe I didn't have alpha-gal syndrome. It just seemed too much of a coincidence. So I tried eating a few other things, had anaphylactic reactions, and yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you presented this to your physician, what was their reaction? And how many doctors did you have to see before you got formally and properly diagnosed?
Well, when I talked to my physician about it, she looked at me with a very skeptical expression, but she's a really open-minded individual, so she was willing to test me for it. And then my number came back really high. But she didn't know anything about it. So then I went to see a local allergist, And the local allergist, at that point I had stopped eating red meat, but I was still eating dairy and gelatin, and I was having, you know, severe GI issues. And I connected the two because I went from not having GI issues to having GI issues. Mm-hmm. And then she said, oh, you probably have colon cancer, you know, go see a gastroenterologist. Yeah. Right. So, you know, then just through online support groups, I learned that this is actually a common phenomenon. I eliminated all the other sources of mammalian exposure from my diet, and carrageenan, because red algae also express alpha gal.
In effect, it's not an animal or a mammal, but it does. It's one of the non-mammalian sources of alpha gal, right?
Exactly. I mean, numerous taxa actually produce alpha gal, bacteria as well. Mm-hmm. So at that point, my husband, who has had terrible GI issues for much of his life and horrible arthritis, said, you know what, my arthritis and my GI symptoms have cleared up. I wonder if I have alpha gal. So we got him tested, and turns out he also has alpha gal syndrome.
So what does the testing entail? It's not a routine test, because you can, you know, allergists will either skin test you, which can demonstrate alpha gal sensitivity, but they often rely on a blood test called the IgE-RAST. And the IgE-RAST, you don't commonly run it for meat. You know, usually run it for more common allergens like eggs and wheat and dairy, you know, perhaps casein or lactalbumin. But they don't generally run it for meat, but it is available. And if you test it for meat, will it come up positive using that conventional test?
Well, let's start with the correct test.
Sure.
The test that you really ought to get exists, and it's for some reason difficult to find online. It's the test for alpha-gal immunoglobulin E. Mm-hmm. And it can be done through LabCorp, it can be done through Quest, but for some reason it doesn't pop up in the usual menu, which can make it really hard for allergists to find. Mm-hmm. So when I was first diagnosed, my doctor didn't know about the alpha-gal IgE test. He tested me for beef, pork, and lamb. Mm-hmm. And I tested positive for beef, low positive for pork, and negative for lamb, and I think negative for gelatin. And this is actually really important for people to understand, because those tests are for protein, mm-hmm. not for right. the carbohydrate. And sometimes they're positive and sometimes they're negative. But whether they're positive or negative doesn't really give you any specific information about the mammalian products that you will react to. So those tests are actually more confusing than anything else. Mm-hmm. The reason that they are test positive is because alpha gal isn't floating around in your serum. It's actually attached to proteins and fats. Okay. So yes, the proteins have alpha gal on them.
Mm-hmm. So they can sometimes co-react, giving you a positive test, but it's not a definitive test because not every culprit food is identified in those tests. And then there's skin testing. And, you know, many allergists use skin testing. Would skin testing from, I mean, I used to do skin testing. I don't think I've ever skin tested anybody for meat. I mean, I tested for more common allergens, but meat allergy, relatively uncommon, like a old fashioned allergy, not alpha gal. But if they put in a little bit of the whatever they use for skin testing for meat, is that a true diagnostic method, or is it hit or miss?
This is actually one of the big diagnostic challenges with alpha gal, is that allergists tend to use skin prick tests, mm-hmm. but skin prick tests are not reliable with commercial extracts of meats, mm-hmm. are not reliable for the diagnosis of alpha gal. And in fact, I've looked at some big studies where they tried to determine what the most common allergies were in different parts of the world. And when they first collect the data and ask parents what children are reacting to, beef and pork are often very high on the list. But then they test the kids, both through an oral food challenge right. and a skin prick test. The skin prick tests are negative, the oral food challenge appears to be negative. I'm sorry, I can't figure out how to turn that.
Don't worry about it. We'll get past it.
It appears to be negative, but it's just that they don't react while they're in the allergist's office. They go home and react 3 to 6 hours later.
Okay, so what you're saying is that these reactions may be delayed and not instantaneous, and therefore it's sometimes hard to pin down because you may say, you know, I think I'm having an allergic reaction, but, you know, it may be hours later, so it's hard to attribute it to whatever antecedent meal you had, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why there's so many misdiagnosed people and why it's taken so long for the world to even recognize that there is such a thing as a meat allergy, because that's a really paradigm-shifting idea. You're supposed to react within a half an hour of eating a food.
Mm-hmm. In a classic food allergy, you know, like the people who, you know, these lurid headlines, the kiss of death, you know, girl kisses her boyfriend who's had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and just merely by having a few molecules of peanut antigen from a kiss, she develops anaphylaxis and dies, tragically. Yeah. That's a classic anaphylactic reaction. And this seems to be sort of betwixt and between classic allergic reactions and what is often thought of as a traditional allergy. So you mentioned the tick connection, and you know there are different types of ticks. There's the so-called dog tick, which is large, sort of like the size of a nail head, and then there's the type of ticks that cause Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. They're very tiny. They're sort of like the pinhead-sized ticks that are common in many states, especially the Northeast. They transmit Lyme disease. Which ticks are responsible for alpha-gal sensitivity?
So I would love to answer that question, but getting back to what you said previously about being somewhere in between classic allergy and atypical allergy. It actually is a classic. Classic type 1 sensitivity. Mm-hmm. It's just that the primary antigenic form of alpha-gal is fat, and it takes a while to break the fat down. So it's actually an immediate reaction, but the reaction doesn't occur until the alpha-gal is exposed in the brown fat. That's another way in which it's a completely paradigm shifting allergy.
Okay. So it does.
But the ticks.
This is a known allergic pathway. It just, by the nature of it, it is a little delayed before it causes the immune system to react.
Yes.
Which makes
it harder.
They call
it a delayed immediate reaction, which I think is kind of a funny way to describe it. But.
Yeah. So-called immediate hypersensitivity. Okay. So then on the tick question, we now know that bizarrely, this is an allergy that is transmitted, right?
Mm-hmm. In the United States, the primary vector of sensitization is the Lone Star tick. And we know that because of the geographic distribution of alpha-gal overlapping so consistently with the distribution of the Lone Star tick. However, around the world, there are numerous species of ticks that can induce alpha-gal. And it's thought that probably most tick species can induce it, just not as frequently. And I think one of the reasons is because Lone Star ticks feed on humans at all stages of their development. So you get bitten by like a bunch of larval Lone Star ticks, and because you have so many bites, you're more likely to develop like full-fledged clinical.
So it's additive. And how about the question of susceptibility? Because I have an alpha-gal patient in my practice, but prior to having alpha-gal, she had a whole panoply of allergies. And so it's almost like her cup had runneth over. And it was an additive effect that on top of being a very allergic person with many food allergies to begin with, She acquired alpha-gal sensitivity and tested positive for it. Is there some synergy between being an allergic type person and the severity of your alpha-gal?
Actually, different groups have looked at that question. And the U.S. groups have found no relationship between, and the Swedish groups have found a relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's an open question.
Okay. But so the point being is you can be perfectly fine, get bitten by a tick, and all of a sudden acquire this bizarre array of sensitivities and allergic reactions.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people who don't have any allergies at all suddenly are bitten by a tick and then mm-hmm. have this severe, often life-threatening
right.
allergy.
And it matters not whether you get bitten by a tick and immediately you're given antibiotics or proper treatment to reduce the risk of Lyme disease or related tick-borne illness, because whatever reaction occurs bypasses the antibiotic efficacy, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The antibiotics don't do anything for it. It doesn't seem to be an infectious process at all.
Right. Right. Okay. So in terms of management of this, it requires a great deal of awareness because it seems to me there's no cure for this. There's no medical treatment. I mean, maybe you can ameliorate it. Perhaps tell me if there's antihistamines, have some benefit here. But it's mostly by vigilance and avoidance that you can minimize symptoms.
Absolutely. I think that's the good news and the bad news. The good news is that I would much rather just have to avoid an allergen than be medicated to cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is it's so pervasive that yeah. it's almost impossible for people who are very sensitive to it.
So how pervasive is it? I mean, I think this is one of those tip of the iceberg phenomena because as you found, it's hard to diagnose. It's kind of insidious. And people vary in their sensitivities, right? There's some people who may have very obvious symptoms and others may have more subtle symptoms, which don't lead them to seek an answer. And they just say, maybe they say, well, I just have some allergic reactions. I get rashes. I have some irritable bowel-like symptoms. They don't know where it's from. They're not doing the detective work to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. It's so pervasive that I could talk to you about it for 8 hours and not and not cover all the bases. But like, for example, you can't eat red meat, so you decide you're going to eat fish and chicken.
Yeah.
Well, chicken is often injected with carrageenan.
Ooh.
Fish is treated with carrageenan to mask the odor and help it retain moisture. Cut fruit could be treated with carrageenan. And gelatin isn't everything. Processed foods are full of things like monoglycerides and diglycerides. Mm-hmm. I actually recommend that people who are highly sensitive to alpha-gal, which of course is the minority of us, but that they completely avoid non-vegan processed foods altogether until they figure out what's making them react.
Okay. This is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. And in part two, I want to talk about what life is like if you're suffering from alpha-gal. Also, does alpha-gal wane with time? There's some thought that it may, for some people, wane in intensity. Our guest is Sharon Forsyth. She's a patient advocate. Her background is in conservation, international conservation, but she herself suffered from alpha-gal syndrome. And as part of her research into its causation and how to cope with it, she created the Alpha-Gal Syndrome Awareness Campaign. Sharon, how do people find out about that?
How do people find out about the alpha-gal syndrome awareness campaign?
Yeah.
The website that we've created is the Alpha-Gal Information website, and that's where most of the information is. The place where people join the campaign really is on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Facebook group, and that's where we organize and plan projects and support each other's efforts.
Great. All right, we'll pause now, and when we return, more on the subject of the epidemic you never heard of, and now you have. It's alpha-gal syndrome. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.